The following is a paid commercial program from the Ulster County Department of Health. This is the Healthy Ulster Radio Show, a weekly talk show exploring community health and sustainability with guests representing a broad spectrum of community partners working to make Ulster County the healthiest in New York State. This program is a community affairs presentation of the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health.
Welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio. My name is Vincent Martello. I'm Director of Community Health Relations for the Ulster County Department of Health. Today, we're going to be discussing HIV and HIV prevention, testing, and treatment. And June 26th is National HIV Testing Day. And a little later on, I'll provide details on how to get free HIV and STI testing right here at Ulster County Department of Health. And our special guest is Dr. Michael Sharon. Dr. Sharon practices primary care internal medicine at Medical Associates of the Hudson Valley in Kingston. And prior to joining Medical Associates, Dr. Sharon practiced internal medicine in Manhattan. He started his post-training career in 1992 at the AIDS Center at St. Vincent's Hospital, where he provided primary care to people living with HIV/AIDS. Dr. Sharon served as the director of the outpatient HIV clinic at St. Vincent's, as well as the AIDS scatter bed program. Dr. Sharon has continued to care for a large number of people living with HIV/AIDS, and he has vast experience in both the treatment and prevention of HIV infection. So, Dr. Sharon, welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Sharon, can we start with the basics as to what HIV is and what the health risks are that are associated with it?
Well, HIV is a virus. It stands for human immunodeficiency virus. It's a virus that spreads from person to person essentially through sexual activity, usually sexual intercourse, or through a significant blood exposure, you know, injection of infected blood through needle sharing or through a blood transfusion. In the past, it was also contaminated the factor VIII supply, so hemophiliacs got that from that blood product. So that's how it's acquired. Once in the system, HIV infects a specific type of white blood cell in the body called a T4 lymphocyte, and it reproduces itself in those lymphocytes and in the process kills them and eventually depletes them. So T4 lymphocytes are extremely important component of the immune system, and once they are depleted by the HIV virus, the body is left unable to fight off certain infections and certain cancers. So eventually what can happen is that, people will start to develop what we call opportunistic infections. In other words, infections that don't cause disease in people with normal immune systems, or they get very specific cancers related to HIV. Plus, there's other complications such as HIV dementia, HIV-related kidney failure that can occur if the virus is not treated and arrested.
And the HIV/AIDS epidemic officially emerged in the United States somewhere around early 1981. How and where was it identified, and what was the response? It seems that it took the medical community writ large by surprise.
The first mention of it was in the CDC's publication, the MMWR. This came out in 1981. And what it was a cluster of cases in San Francisco of gay men who developed an opportunistic pneumonia called pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, or PCP. And they showed signs of, very depleted immune systems. So this one doctor who cared for a lot of gay men in San Francisco noticed this cluster of these very unusual cases, and it got reported. Once that got reported, another doctor in New York City said, hey, I have a group of gay men that also look like their immune systems are bad, and they're getting this aggressive skin cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. Now, Kaposi's sarcoma existed before AIDS, but it's usually in elderly men. It's usually indolent and not aggressive and doesn't kill you. But, this was, again, this cluster of unusual cases in gay men that seemed to look like a bad immune system. Then the reports started pouring in from all over the country of similar cases of gay men with depleted immune systems. Nobody really knew why this was happening. I mean, the thought is that it was likely some sort of infectious agent that was being passed sexually from person to person, but that was not known for a fact. So obviously, panic ensued.
And so what happened next?
Well, what happened? I mean, I'm not sure what happened on the federal level in terms of the NIH getting involved. Obviously, it tried to figure out. The first thing was to figure out what the cause of this was. I mean, what happened in the community was a lot of organizing and activism around the disease. You know, GMHC, the Gay Men's Health Crisis, started in New York City to provide services to gay men as well as to advocate politically, you know, to get some action on this illness, because quite frankly, it was largely ignored by, you know, certainly by the federal government. You know, AMFAR, the AIDS American Foundation for AIDS Research started, ACT UP eventually started, which is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. So lots of community organizing to put pressure on the government to start to take this seriously. Because I really thought initially, you know, many people's attitude, oh, this is only going to affect this one population. It's a population that was stigmatized in the, or you know, devalued in the first place. And it was felt like, well, this isn't our problem. And maybe some people even felt, oh, they're getting what they deserve. So there was an under response, to say the very least. I mean, AIDS was defined in 1981. Ronald Reagan first mentioned it at all in 1985. You know, he had been president for those four years without saying a word about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you were pretty much at ground zero. What were you seeing in your day-to-day work?
Well, in 1981, I was still a college student, but by the time I hit medical school and residency, we were already starting to see cases in the hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, I did my residency at St. Luke's Roosevelt in Manhattan, which had a very large AIDS population, and I got an enormous amount of experience. Now, again, back then, there was no treatment for the virus itself, or very little effective treatment for the virus itself. What we really did was treat the complications. So people would come in with pneumocystis pneumonia, you would treat the pneumonia, you would send them home, then they would come back with a different opportunistic infection, maybe CMV in their retina, which is, you know, can cause blindness, or they, you know, they come in with certain types of fungal meningitis. And essentially you kept treating each complication until they succumbed and you lost them. Wow. You know, it wasn't really until the late 1980s and early 1990s when we actually started to develop antiviral agents that would fight the virus itself and would, you know, keep the virus in check, mm-hmm. you know, so people's immune systems would recover.
Mm-hmm. And so there was, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a concurrent epidemic in Africa, which at the time ostensibly they thought HIV originated in Africa.
HIV AIDS probably did originate in Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems pretty clear that that is the case. And HIV in Africa was very different epidemiologically than in the United States or in Europe. It was largely spread as a heterosexual disease. So there were equal numbers of men and women with it. There were also many young women of childbearing, you know, age who contracted HIV. So there was an enormous problem with perinatal AIDS, you know, babies being born with HIV that they had gotten from their mother. And it was really devastating. I mean, it's estimated it set, you know, economic development in Africa back at least 10 years, and not to mention the extreme suffering and death. You know, you'd have both parents die, you would have a grandparent taking care of an HIV-infected infant that was going to die, and this was going on all over the continent.
So that, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go.
No, I was going to say that. So as this is happening in Africa, and then it's showing up in the United States, what was the international community, like the World Health Organization and those types of organizations, doing in terms of coordinating effort, trying to, I mean, was there a logical and consistent and effort to try to understand what this is and come up with an appropriate collective and integrated response?
Well, remember, I mean, even in the most economically developed places in the world at that time, there was no good treatment. I mean, you really were treating complications, and you know, once you had pneumocystis, your life expectancy was 18 months. Even if you are, you know, a wealthy person living in New York City with access to all the hospitals there, mm-hmm. so it's not like there was much to offer other than trying to prevent, you know, prevention plans, trying to encourage, you know, abstinence, sexual fidelity, condom use, you know, trying to provide services for AIDS orphans, you know, all of that was being done, but there wasn't a heck of a lot to do until effective antivirals came out. Mm-hmm. Now, effective antivirals came out in this country in 1996 with the onset of the protease inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And that truly reversed everything. I mean, that would make people's, you know, essentially stop reproduction of the virus in the body. It would allow the immune system to recover. Virus in the body became so low that it was unmeasurable, or what we call undetectable. And people, you know, really turned around. The issue is this: those drugs are quite expensive.
Right.
So here we have these life-saving drugs that are saving people's lives in the United States, in Africa, and in other places. And yet there's not a lot of availability because of cost and logistics. This actually changed with George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. He started something called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, mm-hmm. and got together with pharmaceuticals, got together with money, and actually was able to provide antiviral care at low or no cost to millions of people in Africa. Mm-hmm. He spent about $120 billion and have probably saved about 25, 26 million lives and really, wow. you know, wow. rolled back a tragedy. Now, unfortunately, with DOGE, that has all been put on hold. There's a 90-day freeze on all of this spending. So I'm very afraid that one of the biggest humanitarian successes in the world may get reversed now.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to learn more about this and discuss this even further. But first, we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio, and we'll be back after these words.
Westchester Medical Center Health Network's new Health Alliance Hospital is open in Kingston at 105 Mary's Avenue. The new hospital delivers on WMC Health's commitment to provide access to advanced healthcare right here in this community. Our comfortable and welcoming new Health Alliance Hospital has highly skilled doctors, nurses, and staff. We are ready to make your healthcare experience the best it can be. Here are just a few of the services ready to take care of you and your loved ones when you need us. A new emergency department with 24/7 triage for behavioral health needs, life-saving advanced cardiology programs, family birth center, private rooms, precise imaging technology, critical care support. And later this year, our inpatient psychiatry program will be reestablished to complement existing emergency and outpatient programs. Go to hahv.org for information. That's hahv.org.
I'm Angela Bassett. As a first responder on screen, I know what it means to act fast in an emergency. In real life, the same urgency can save lives, especially when it comes to a food allergy. For 33 million Americans, one bite can turn an ordinary meal into a life-threatening reaction. And too often, they don't have the one thing that could save them. Epinephrine. But emergencies don't wait. And when a severe reaction happens, being prepared makes all the difference. Now, there's a needle-free option, a new way to carry epinephrine that makes it easier than ever to be ready. No needles, no hesitation. Because when the unexpected happens, the best thing you can do is be ready. Know the risk, know the options. Be ready to act. Learn more at foodallergy.org/ready to act.
I'm Amy Grant, and I want to talk to you from my heart about the heart. There was nothing about my life that said, you have a ticking time bomb in your chest. But I did. I wound up in the office of a cardiologist because I was there with my husband. And at the tail end of that, the cardiologist looked at me and said, I want to see you. No one was more surprised than I was to learn I was living with a rare heart condition. He said, Amy, this condition, you'll be fine, and then catastrophic. A few months later, I had open heart surgery that saved my life. And I owe it to the research and life-saving medical breakthroughs developed by the American Heart Association. I'm grateful for the American Heart Association. Their research gave me more time to do the things I love with the people I love. So listen to your heart. I'm here today because I did. Learn more at helpheart.org.
And now, Healthy Ulster continues. This is a weekly presentation of the Ulster County Department of Health on 92.9 WBPM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio, and we're talking with Dr. Michael Sharon about HIV and HIV prevention, testing, and treatment. And June 26th is National HIV Testing Day, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. So, Dr. Sharon, before the break, we talked about how and where HIV/AIDS emerged, how it kind of took countries and the medical community by surprise, and the response to it in terms of treating symptoms, not really having a way to stop it, but to just to treat the symptoms. So, talk to us a little bit about the antivirals that you mentioned and their efficacy and how that came about.
Okay. Well, the first antiretroviral that came out was AZT back in probably 1983 or so. And their study came out showing that people who had fully diagnosed AIDS, not just HIV positive, but who had AIDS and who had pneumocystis, lived a few weeks longer if they were treated with AZT versus being treated with the placebo. Now, clearly it was not a cure. It only bought a few weeks worth of time. And there was a lot of toxicity, especially at the doses that were used. The biggest problem was, although these medicines inhibit the virus from reproducing, they don't 100% stop it. So if you were using the drugs one at a time, you would not suppress the virus enough to prevent it from reproducing, and eventually it would evolve to become resistant to the medication. And it happened fairly quickly, within weeks. The biggest change in the mid-90s was that newer classes of drugs came out so that you could use the drugs in combination. And when used in combinations of three drugs at a time, you could actually turn off viral reproduction altogether. So the virus stopped reproducing. And that way you could actually get what we call an undetectable viral load. In other words, no trace of virus, detectable in the bloodstream. People's immune systems recover, they get better. And also an important note is at that point, they are no longer able to transmit the virus to other people. So not only is it positive for the person being treated, it is also a public health measure to prevent the spread, to get people treated and undetectable.
So viruses, the way viruses cause damage are they're basically hardwired to replicate, right? And
yes.
So when they reach a certain threshold in your body, when they replicate enough to make you sick, because like in the instances with COVID, like the antivirals like Paxlovid and those types of things we have, they actually don't eliminate the virus entirely. They just inhibit replication.
So yeah, they lower your level of virus to the point that your immune system can kill, can take over.
Right.
But with HIV, you're actually stopping replication, at least the visible replication that you can measure with a blood test. You're pretty much turning it off.
And do you have to continue to take the medication?
Yes,
for the
because
rest of
you
your
have
life?
Not eradicated the virus. HIV virus inserts a copy of itself into the DNA of certain white blood cells. So if you kill every living virus in the bloodstream and turn and stop the medication, the little copy of the virus that is inserted into the DNA of your own cells will eventually cause replication to start again.
Wow.
So unfortunately, these are not curative treatments, and they are at this point lifelong.
Wow.
We may eventually get to the point where we eradicate the infection completely, but we're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. And are there any types of like mRNA types of approaches being taken, or is that just
No, there's no mRNA approaches that I'm aware of being taken.
Right.
And unfortunately, preventive vaccine for HIV has been very unsuccessful. They've, despite decades of trying, there has not been a good preventive vaccine developed for HIV.
Let's shift gears for a moment to prevention in terms of enhanced prevention. Who's most at risk of contracting HIV/AIDS?
Okay.
And what are some of the most, what are the best preventative measures? As
all right. So if you look at nationwide statistics of who is still getting HIV, first of all, the good news is it's dropped. I mean, in 2018, there's about 36,000 new HIV infections. That dropped to about 31,800 by 2022, about a 12% decline. And the decline in New York State has even been greater than that. So we are finally, after decades of seeing it stay steady or rise, we've finally seen it go down. The people who are still at most risk, it's still men who have sex with men, so gay and bisexual men, still account for a little over two-thirds of all new HIV diagnoses. About 22% of cases are heterosexual spread, and about 7% are from injection drugs. Men having sex with men is still the, you know, predominant transmission, although certainly not the only. The other thing is this disproportionately affects racial and ethnic minorities. You know, about almost, you know, it's about 60% or more, or almost 70% of all new cases of HIV occur in African-American or Latino Hispanic people. Mm-hmm. So that is still, and then younger age groups are also disproportionately affected with, you know, very large numbers. The biggest group that gets newly diagnosed is between the ages of 24 and 35, but we also see a fair number of cases in the even younger, the 13 to 24 group. So, you know, to sum it up, young men who have sex with men who are, you know, African-American or Hispanic Latino are at the highest risk. Geographically, the southern United States is the highest risk. Almost 50% of all new HIV cases occur in that region, as opposed to 14% in our region.
Mm-hmm. So do you attribute the disparities to lack of awareness and education, or are there other factors in there?
Well, I mean, I think lack of accessing health care, denial about being in certain risk groups or being in certain, you know, engaging in risk behaviors may be part of it. And again, just lack of access to getting regular medical care.
There was a lot of, and continues to be, I think, stigma associated with HIV/AIDS. How can we as individuals and as a community help to raise awareness and diminish that stigma? Yeah.
I mean, first of all, compared to what I witnessed, you know, 30 years ago, the degree of stigma and discrimination, I think, is far less. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look back in 1987, neighbors burned down the house of three, you know, young kids who had hemophiliac kids who had HIV. They burned their house to the ground. Yikes. The Ray brothers. I mean, that kind of stuff does not happen anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest way to decrease the stigma is, you know, that people have to understand this is not a death sentence. People do not die from this. That if you get diagnosed and get treated, you can live pretty much a normal lifespan, and you can even get to the point where you cannot transmit this to other people.
And in terms of prevention for everyone, what are a few of the best practices?
Okay, so for an individual who is HIV negative, I mean, one is to just decrease your exposure. I mean, people probably don't talk about it as much, but, you know, limiting the number of sexual partners you have, it goes a long way. Condom use, which, you know, I think has fallen by the wayside to a large extent, is extremely effective at preventing not just HIV, but other sexually transmitted infections. Treating any other sexually transmitted infection also lowers the risk of getting HIV, because people who have gonorrhea or syphilis or chlamydia or herpes are much more likely to contract HIV because you have lesions that will allow virus to get into your body. So, mm-hmm. you know, getting regular medical care, and if you're sexually active, getting tested and treated for other STIs. And finally, there is something called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is essentially taking an antiviral on a daily basis to prevent getting infected. Wow. And it's quite effective. It's, you know, if taken properly, it prevents about, you know, probably 98-99% of infection.
And I should note here, Dr. Sharon, that June, as I mentioned earlier, June 26 is National HIV Testing Day, and the Ulster County Department of Health offers free HIV and STI testing on Monday evenings from 5 to 7 by appointment only. We're located at 239 Golden Hill Lane in Kingston, and the phone number to make an appointment is 845-340-3090. So finally, Dr. Sharon, if our listeners would like more information on HIV/AIDS prevention, detection, and treatment, where are the best places to go for reliable information, how can they reach you?
Okay. Well, the New York State Department of Health has an excellent website. I mean, if you just go onto the main website for the New York State Department of Health and type in HIV/AIDS, there is enormous amount of information, not just for healthcare providers, but also for lay people as well. And I've looked through it. It's extremely understandable, digestible, it's non-biased, and it's accurate. So that is certainly a great place to get information.
Mm-hmm. And to reach out to you and perhaps make an appointment, or how do they do that?
They can call our office here at Medical Associates of the Hudson Valley here in Kingston. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Sharon, you know, this the work that you've done in the past and present and will continue to do is invaluable to individuals in our community, and we are so grateful for your dedication and your expertise. Thank you for sharing it with us. And you're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Tune in next week for more great information that you can use to keep yourself, your family, and our community healthy and strong. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Healthy Ulster Radio Show from the Ulster County Department of Health. This program is a weekly community affairs presentation sponsored by the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us for another edition of the Healthy Ulster Radio Show next weekend.